Welcome back to the New Books Network's African American Studies channel. I am your host, Adam McNeil, a PhD student in the Department of History at the University of Delaware. Today we have on the podcast Dr. Ian Roxburgh-Smith, who teaches North American and Global History at the University of Fraser Valley and Douglas College in British Columbia. Shout out to Canada. We are featuring his new book, published this year by the University of Illinois Press, entitled Black Public History in Chicago, Civil Rights Activism from World War II into the Cold War Era. And so, welcome to the show, Dr. Ian Roxburgh-Smith.
Thanks, Adam, for having me, and just please call me Ian throughout.
Oh, believe me, it's one of those funny things where I'm like, you know, I'm a Southern kid, and it's like a Southern American kid, and it's like, you know, you got to make sure to give people their titles, Adam. And I'm like, I have that in my head. So I will always let people tell me like, yo, I'm not with that doctor stuff. I am Ian. I am insert whatever. So you hear that, mom? I know you're listening. So Ian said it. So just putting that out there. So what a great way to begin. Before we get into the contents of Black Public History in Chicago, Ian, would you be able to give us a bit of the story of how you got to this particular book? Because you know you're as we talked before, you know you're a Canadian guy, you know, out in Vancouver. So how did a Vancouver guy slide on over to Chicago and get engaged with this phenomenal history?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, a lot of people when they hear that I just published a book on African-American history in Chicago, they're like, how did you end up doing that? And, you know, it's kind of a long-winded story. I'll try to be as brief as I can, but it, you know, it connects with sort of like an honest intellectual engagement and interest that I've always had in African-American history, and especially the history of sort of the middle of the 20th century and the civil rights and anti-racist struggles of those periods, you know, in part because they relate so much to, you know, what's going on today in the world and in America. And you know, so when I was an undergrad, I was really fortunate to meet a veteran elder of the civil rights movement who coincidentally retired to my hometown of Vancouver. His name's Jack O'Dell, and he worked really closely with Dr. King in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And before that, he'd been involved in the Merchant Marines and actually a member of the Communist Party of the United States for a period of time. So he was on, you know, the very radical left of the political spectrum. And when he worked with Dr. King, he was one of the chief fundraisers in the movement through the early 60s. When the FBI went after the movement, he was one of the people who was singled out and had to leave SCLC for a time. And he joined the editor board of Freedom Waves magazine in New York. And so when I was doing my master's program, a number of years ago, I worked on a thesis about the history of Freedom Waves magazine. And I noticed when I was working on that project that one of the other editors that he worked with initially with the magazine or the journal was a woman named Margaret Burroughs, who was the first arts editor of Freedom Waves magazine. And I noticed that she left the magazine after a short time. And, you know, I always wondered what she did. So when I went on to my PhD studies, I went to the University of Toronto, and my supervisor there, Rick Halpern, is a scholar of Black Chicago, of working class movements in Chicago through the middle of the 20th century. And he wrote about especially meatpacking workers and the United Packing House Workers of America and sort of the interracial activism that came out of the 1930s and 40s. The meatpacking workers were among the sort of most advanced workers in terms of advocating against racism and for civil rights through the middle decades of the 20th century, probably one of the most progressive unions in the country at that time. And he said, well, you should study Chicago more. I mean, lots of people were working on the Black left in New York. Why don't you work on Chicago? And I already knew about Margaret Burroughs and that she had these connections to Chicago, and sort of just followed her her life story and the sort of work that she was doing with her friends and colleagues on what I viewed as effectively Black public history. It was public history activism. It was building museums, curriculum for public schools, supporting local history organizations and societies that we're working on getting Black history into the public sphere. And I viewed a lot of this as, you know, a form of civil rights activism, because it was a period in American history, of course, where there was a lot of repression. It was the Cold War, the early Cold War still. Especially anyone who was advocating civil rights, no matter what their political ideology was often viewed as, you know, potentially treasonous or often surveyed by the state. And so, you know, wanted to understand, you know, what people were doing to kind of endure that moment. And one of the sort of main ideas in my book is that people worked on public history as a way to sort of negotiate that moment in American history, but also to make an impact on social change and to advocate for, you know, a form of civil rights. And that is advocating for Black public history in the public realm. And so, you know, this was a work that I did ultimately for a PhD dissertation, and then I've revised it in this book. So hopefully it's a bit better now that it's in a book form. So yeah, that's my long-winded explanation of how I got into this.
Well, hey, I truly believe that our listeners are definitely going to enjoy that they are enjoying, you know, this particular story, because it's, you know, it always is remarkable and pretty cool to hear about how people get into the topics that they ultimately, you know, go into that, you know, spark their interest for the entireties of their whole careers. Like, we're talking like multiple decades. And so to me, this particular story was really cool because it, you know, you spoke about it briefly just now. Public history and education and really also collective memory too, a portion that's ingrained in Black resistance. And so I never thought about it, and considering the particular era at which this is occurring, World War II into the Cold War, that is just like changing everything. Because right, the Cold War, you know, if you don't have, you know, the technological advances of the late 40s and going into the 50s with how technology is changing and televisions and such like that, you know, some people make the claim that the Cold War would not have, and really the Black gains in American society couldn't have happened without the Cold War, because showing to the world like what's going on, but also internally about how, you know, Black activism is so, you know, so formulated with, you know, the education struggles. I had someone on the program earlier in the last couple of weeks, Hillary Green, for her book Educational Reconstruction, about how education and democracy and citizenship are ingrained with each other. And I see definite connections to your work here with Black Public History in Chicago. So definitely big ups on that one.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of connections to be made in terms of, like, you know, progressive education activism that was going on, you know, throughout this entire period. And it connects to a lot of, you know, scholarship that's out there, you know, in different fields, not just history, but, you know, public history, educational studies, and African-American studies, you know, critical race studies. I think there's a lot of ways we can make connections. And I, you know, I'm sure I just know the tip of the iceberg in the way that you can make connections with this kind of project, I think.
No. And I definitely agree with that. Because also, would you be able to speak a bit about how, you know, how your book gets off the ground with the particular subjects that you're speaking about? Because when we talk about, you know, museums in Chicago, and we talk about museums just in general, I feel like a lot of times now with the new Smithsonian museum for African American history and culture, I feel like that has taken up so much of the oxygen that there's not enough for the other museums as well. And obviously we know Lonnie Bunch and everybody out there, you know, doing great work and bringing people to DC to go check out that phenomenal obelisk. But there's some great areas that predated them too that are doing some phenomenal work as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, one of the things that, my book and other books speak to is kind of the history of even the sort of movements that we're pushing for an institution like the Smithsonian Museum to finally occur. And like, I have a section in my book, and it's sort of built on what other scholars like Mabel Wilson and Andrea Burns have written about. They looked at these efforts in the middle to late 1960s by people like Margaret Burroughs and also Dr. Charles Wright from Detroit, who founded the what's now the Charles Wright Museum of African American History there. They were both sort of key figures in a consultation that actually happened with some government officials in the late 60s that initially kind of envisioned the first sort of national museum of African American history. And they, one of the major points that they made at these hearings, and I outlined it a bit in my book as well, is that there needed to be more public consultations with grassroots independent museum organizations like the DuSable Museum in Chicago or the museum in Detroit that was started by Charles Wright and his associates there, that there needs to be more consultation with these independent museum bodies for there to be, you know, a more kind of just formation of a national or federal museum at the national level. And something that, you know, obviously it took, you know, decades, as you sort of alluded to there with Lonnie Bunch and the figures who were able to finally bring that institution into being. But I mean, you think about the amount of time that took place between the late 60s and now for something like that to finally occur. And, you know, they were debating it then, but it was clear that there were tensions and, you know, unresolved issues about how that whole project would be formed. And, you know, that's a whole other series of studies that could be done. And but it just in terms of understanding that there have been many of these independent museums that have existed, you know, for a long time that, that, you know, were built from the bottom up and connected to community and grassroots efforts at, you know, public education, at public history, and, you know, really advocating a form of civil rights, I think, in that moment as well. Like, if we're thinking about the middle of the 20th century and the kind of things that were stacked against anyone who was trying to do something like that in that period of time.
And with that as well, I think when we look at the city of Chicago and how, you know, your time frame, you know, being in the kind of like that middle, like that late, I was about mid 20th century time frame, there's so much going on. You know, Chicago is such a center, right? People like Ida B. Wells and Oscar DePriest and others had been making major names of themselves through Chicago as well. And so, you know, Chicago had a particular vibrance with Black folks there. And so, you know, when we look at things like your first chapter, curriculum reforms in World War II Chicago, what were some of the conversations that were being had in looking at not only them being activists within the World War II context, but also looking at what kind of curriculum reforms could they really drive? Because it seemed that so much of the resources and so much of the minds of many Americans, and, you know, Black and white at times as well, were very much focused on the World War II effort. And so would you be able to talk to us a bit about what those conversations were during that time frame about that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, those curriculum reforms during the 40s, I think, you know, it was important that they were happening in Chicago. I mean, Chicago was, you know, as you know, and as you already kind of pointed to, with the emergence of major public figures like Ida B. Wells, you know, came to Chicago from Memphis and the early 20th century, and major, you know, activists against lynching, and Oscar DePriest, you know, a major local Black politician, you know, it really, they came to kind of embody this long tradition of, you know, like, the growth of a Black metropolis in Chicago, and, you know, one of the major northern centers where people moved to over the course of the Great Migration periods, you know, World War I to the Second World War. And I think that, you know, Chicago, you know, had always been this kind of major site of movement and growth of Black American communities. And it was sort of through that period of history in World War II. And it was sort of natural for, especially for sort of knowledge production projects to kind of emerge out of that moment that were connected to, in part, as you said, the war effort, you know, trying to present kind of an American universalism or something like that in that period. And, you know, it made sense for people who were also advocating against discrimination in that moment to kind of use the wartime opportunity to kind of push for that further, right? If you think about like the double victory campaigns that were waged by especially African-American newspapers in that same period, you know, fighting against fascism in Europe as well as fascism in the United States when it came to like Jim Crow segregation. And I think that, you know, having a curriculum reform project in a city like Chicago, which, you know, had this vibrant, also Black cultural renaissance that came out of the 1930s and 40s that also meant that there were lots of people working on like cultural work, you know, literary groups, you know, people putting on plays connected to, you know, this really kind of vibrant intellectual community that was on the south side of Chicago. And I think that the people who were working on curriculum reforms, like Madeline Stratton Morris and her husband Sam Stratton, you know, were very much connected to that community. They were public school teachers on the south side in that period. And, you know, they were interested in, you know, changing the curriculum of the very schools that they taught in, which, of course, at that time had to conform to this, you know, whatever standards were set by the Chicago school board and ultimately by the state. You know, they needed to kind of work against that. But they were also emboldened by the kind of very vibrant Black cultural activism that persisted through that period, that was, you know, really trying to use that wartime period as an opportunity to kind of push for gains in terms of anti-discrimination. I mean, it's also the period of like, you know, the first, you know, the bluffed attempt at the March on Washington that led by Philip Randolph, you know, desegregating defense industry. I mean, there's all kinds of things happening nationally where you can sort of set up the coordinates of activism in World War II, and really that kind of opening wedge to the sort of long civil rights moment of the middle of the 20th century.
And with that as well, you know, like you just mentioned, it seemed like all events pointed back to Chicago in some way. It was even going all the way back to the 1893 Columbian Exhibition with Douglas and Wells and other folks too. And so, you know, Chicago has a long legacy of activism. And so, you know, one thing that I thought was also interesting too, you know, someone like Carter G. Woodson, right? You talk about curriculum reforms and such like that. One of the things that that struck me when I first started to learn about, you know, a lot of your early 20th century and mid 20th century historians, they were not just writing for the academy. A lot of them were writing curriculums for Black teachers. I thought that that was something that was really an intriguing portion to learn about, because you also have webs of that in your book, especially in this particular chapter.
Absolutely, yeah. And I'm really just sort of trying to sort of, you know, convey the work that, like, really important work done by Professor Pero Dagbovi on, you know, the Black history movement as it emerges out of, you know, the 1910s and the whole efforts of Carter G. Woodson and his associates to build the what's now the Association for the Study of African-American Life and History, which I think is the oldest or longest running African-American history organization in the country. And, you know, just the sort of networks of local people, not only in Chicago, of course, it was built in Chicago initially and then moved to D.C., but there were networks of people all across the country, mostly women, you know, club women, people who were school teachers, who started these like local history societies, you know, in all kinds of random places as well as big cities. You know, like you said, they were building these, you know, what were effectively public school curriculums. Like if you go back and watch the or read the old editions of the Negro History Bulletin, you can get a sense of this because there's these write-ups on like local efforts at building local history societies or modules for public schools, right from the sort of early decades of the 20th century when Carter G. Woodson's movement is kind of being built. And you see a lot of it in like the 30s, 40s, and 50s too, I think. And it's fascinating. I think it would be like a mine for future scholars to just keep looking at some of these local efforts and connecting the dots.
And how did these teachers really try to not only blend in the history, but also to build in a component of cultural pride as well? Because I thought that was also something that I found cool to learn about, was not only how, you talk about the Negro history clubs and the Black history clubs, or the different plays that went on, right? Because I even remember reading that about Charlotte Fortin during the Civil War down in Port Royal, South Carolina, and how she's teaching her students about Toussaint Louverture, right? And how, in the context of the 1863, right in the confines of war, she's teaching students about, Black history, and to say that, yeah, Black folks have, there's more to our history than enslavement, though, you shouldn't be necessarily ashamed of it, but there's more to the story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, I'm sure that you could look at like Reconstruction era schools and find, that there were people working on sort of alternative curriculum that wouldn't have been necessarily part of any kind of officially sanctioned, modules that relate to, affirming Black identities in moments of oppression, right? That, especially coming out of the Civil War period, or you can think about, what Ida B. Wells was doing, like the 1890s, anti-lynching campaigns, and then connecting that to, affirming the identities and histories of Black Americans in the late 19th century. So I think in any given moment, you can probably make the case that there are people who are working on similar efforts to affirm, these kinds of identities, and perhaps even call it, a form of public history or of history making. And I think maybe that's the theoretical discussion you'd have, is like, at what point does it become like officially a form of public history or a form of history making, right? I think that there's discussions we can have about that, but it doesn't seem like a lot of people make those connections, in terms of understanding that people have been doing these kinds of things under moments, especially of duress and incredible oppression, and continue to kind of work on projects that are similarly, producing knowledge, right?
Mm-hmm. And so, and that's why I thought that this opening chapter was really a great way to introduce your topic, because it allowed for, myself and the other readers to be able to have a grounding with kind of the foundational levels, because, education is really at the foundation of it all. Because to be a public historian is about, necessarily how do you educate a mass group that's, not necessarily academic, but you're also not limited to them. So how do you make this information as palatable to your audiences? And so that could be a teacher, that could be someone that like an interpreter, a docent. So I really appreciated that part. And then you also got to see some of the important figures like Stratton, Morris, and you had already talked about Mrs. Burroughs as well. And so that I thought was a phenomenal way to really begin it. But then you also get to see some of how, folks like Du Bois, Woodson, Apthecker, these different historians, how they're kind of getting involved in this particular process too. And you see how politically this is very vibrant too, because you have a lot of members of the left that are getting involved in these processes as well. of the far left, of the radical left, I should say.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people realize that it's like a strategic thing that they can get involved in, right? Like, in order to kind of further, you know, not necessarily their agenda, but like what they're politically committed to, right? Which is, you know, in for the case of many of these black leftists, is it's like fundamentally, you know, trying to reconstruct American society to, you know, advance social change beyond kind of a, you know, a moderate level, right? And you know, sometimes, you know, you can make those you can have those discussions about, you know, to what degree were people, if they were, you know, within, say, the communist left, were they, you know, following dictates from Moscow? And you know, certainly that was true of many people who associated with the radical left or the communist left through the middle decades of the 20th century. And I think we need to be aware of that. But at the same time, a lot of these figures, you know, Paul Robeson, Du Bois, even Herbert Aptheker, were, you know, also genuinely working on projects that were, you know, critically important to, you know, advancing the cause of, you know, civil rights, of social justice in America. You know, if you think of like Aptheker's studies on like slave rebellions, you know, some of it we know now to be a bit embellished, but at the same time, it was really critical documentary, you know, primary source research that he did. And that kind of work is stuff that influenced some of these curriculum reformers that I looked at in the 40s. You know, I think beyond influencing the historical profession has also, you know, gone beyond the academy. And I think that, you know, people have been making these connections, you know, in the public realm, outside of the academy. And that's where, you know, a lot of this, this work is most important. I think a lot of these figures through this period, you know, the major figures that are mentioned in my book, like Du Bois, who's working with the Afro-American Heritage Association, and figures like Ishmael Flory, who was a Southside Communist Party organizer. You know, I think Du Bois realized in this moment that, you know, these local organizations could make an impact because they were at the grassroots level. They were working with people, you know, on the ground rather than, you know, the groups like AMSAC, the American Society for the Study of African Culture, which was that CIA-funded organization. You probably heard of them, and they you know, are very problematic in terms of how we conceive of them, especially considering that it was like an arm of the state, you know, effectively because of being funded by the CIA. So Du Bois was well aware of this, and so he looked to, you know, other groups and institutions that were working, you know, that likely against that kind of agenda. I think it's important that we have a sense of that, you know, those tensions and those, you know, diversity of tactics. And, you know, like, I think there's some, you know, it's worth looking at AMSAC still and the people who were involved in it and the things that they produced, because it's still part of this moment. It's part of like knowledge production in that period, but it's just to be aware that there was really, you know, a lot of tension in politics involved in this too, that's connected to, you know, the Cold War politics of that period and, you know, different agendas and, you know, structures of power and how knowledge gets produced, right?
So yeah, Du Bois, from taking the cue from the work of Dr. Chad Williams at Brandeis, working with Du Bois on the First World War, I think Du Bois had learned his lesson a long time ago with World War One about getting involved in anything government subsidized when it came to this kind of deal where such high stakes. And so self-esteem of black children is definitely high stakes when it comes to education. So I definitely think that he learned his lesson. And then also getting into your next chapter, you know, we had mentioned about the Disabled Museum and you know, its importance along with the museum in Detroit as well, the Charles Wright. You know, you're imagining a black museum in Cold War Chicago. Would you be able to set the scene of kind of like what was the origin story really of what became the Disabled Museum and how you know, prior generations had kind of dreamed it into its actual existence and made it work.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I really kind of saw the growth and the building of the museum as kind of connected to the different efforts that especially Margaret Burroughs and her husband Charles Burroughs were doing through the 1940s and 1950s to kind of work on education efforts, on public history efforts. They were initially, especially Margaret Burroughs, was part of an organization. Sorry, the name just escaped me. The National Negro Museum and Heritage Foundation, which I argue in the book was connected to the National Negro Congress, which was an important civil rights organization that my friend Eric Gelman has written extensively about. That emerged in the 1930s and 40s, and it was like a coalition of black labor and civil rights leaders. Many of them were leftists, but also included people like A. Philip Randolph, who was a leftist, but obviously anti-communist. And so the Museum and Heritage Foundation was kind of like one of the cultural arms of this organization, and it was active, and it kind of expressed the first vision for a museum in Chicago in like the 1940s. And then it really didn't get anything off the ground. It was just kind of imagining the museum. And Burroughs was a part of this, and Sam Stratton was a part of this organization. A number of other people who I mentioned in the book. And so Burroughs never really kind of lost the desire to kind of build a museum. And she kind of took that vision for a museum and kept it alive through the 1950s. In partnership with her husband Charles Burroughs, as well as other figures like Eugene Feldman, who is a fascinating figure, a Jewish American background, who was basically an autodidact in terms of Black history, and really got involved with the building of the museum, and then a number of other figures helped to kind of build the museum and launch it finally in 1961 as the Ebony Museum of Black History and Art. And so that was the first name of it. And then it evolved eventually into, took the name of DuSable, which was that, the first settler of Chicago of Haitian background who came in the 18th century to the city. That's sort of how that vision for a museum got started. In Chicago, and I think that there are, there are independent museums like this that have existed elsewhere in the country as well that still need to be kind of, their stories still need to be told as well. I can think of Anacostia Museum, I think, in D.C. There's the Freedom House Muriel Snowden in Boston. There's lots of museums. So the DuSable Museum is not the only one, but I think it was arguably one of the first to kind of, build itself as an explicitly African-American history museum, like devoted to history or as a museum. Whereas others, might've had other foci like, repertoire theaters or, different, cultural forms that they emphasized. That's in a nutshell where that vision is coming from, I think. And it spans that like 1930s to 1960s long civil rights periodization. And I think that that's where I see the kind of origins of that particular vision for the museum. Margaret Burroughs is the key figure here, of course.
And so with the museum, what were some of the difficulties and some of the challenges that were faced by Margaret Burroughs and the rest of the staff at the DuSable Museum? Because it seems like there was some resistance at times to what they were trying to do there.
Totally, yeah, and I think during the 1950s, before they actually got the museum off the ground, Margaret Burroughs was a part of, a group that actually tried to form a chapter of the of ASALA, which then was called the Association of the Study of Negro Life and History. So they tried to restart a chapter there. There hadn't been a chapter since the 1930s, like a consistently running chapter. They actually had their application for a local chapter blocked by a local clubwoman in the city who basically opposed the effort to establish this chapter, and on I think what were basically ideological reasons. This was something that, you know, it meant that there wasn't really an active chapter over the course of the 1950s of the ASNLH. And, you know, I think it was indicative of the kind of opposition that, you know, the particular group that Margaret Burroughs was associated with, which was more to the left of the political spectrum. You know, Margaret Burroughs had close associations with black communists. She herself, I think, was what we could call a fellow traveler, someone who, you know, was sympathetic to the left or the far left. You know, I think that they faced repression. You know, she was a school teacher as well on the South Side, and she actually got in trouble with the school board as well as with Southside Community Arts Center, which was another really important cultural institution on the South Side that had a board of directors in the 1950s that was becoming increasingly conservative and, you know, wanted to prevent people like her from having influence on the sort of programs of the cultural center. So, you know, in the different areas of her life where she was working and being an activist when it came to being an artist and an educator, she was facing challenges, and she eventually had to go to, she took a sabbatical, which was what she was entitled to as a school teacher in Chicago, took a year off, went to Mexico and painted and learned with some radical Mexican artists. And I think, you know, with all these experiences, she was also, you know, surveyed and monitored by the FBI over this period and Chicago Red Squads, which were like the local arm of security state and during the Cold War period in a lot of American cities. And of course, black Americans were especially targeted, you know, regardless of their ideology during this period. And she faced all of these kinds of challenges. You know, continued to do what she was doing, which is trying to educate young people, trying to make a difference in the community. And she always maintained her connections back in Chicago and came back from her experience in Mexico in the early and mid-50s and, you know, got right back to work at sort of envisioning this museum that had never been built yet, the one that the that had been first envisioned during the activism period of the National Negro Congress in like the 40s. And she'd been involved in that period as well. She was much younger and just starting out as a school teacher. But through, you know, all these challenges during the early Cold War, she just kept that vision alive. And, you know, these friends of and associates of hers encouraged her, and they were able to eventually rent out a coach house on South Michigan Avenue that they converted into the first sort of workable space to build this museum in. And it's just really kind of fascinating that they were able to, you know, maintain that vision despite the challenges and the political opposition they had to, you know, forming local black history groups or, you know, getting alternative curriculum into their classrooms or, you know, trying to do art projects on the South Side that, you know, were avant-garde or were kind of against the grain. So, you know, it's you know, I had this fascinating source from this college instructor in Chicago named St. Clair Drake, who was, you know, an icon as well of African studies. And at that time, he was a college instructor at Roosevelt University and, you know, really really sharp mind and really kind of in tune with what was happening. And, you know, he was observing the sort of tensions of the Cold War period, especially, and, you know, what was happening to the radical left. And I think he felt that there were some people who were being channeled into black history efforts. And from his point of view, this was kind of, you know, it meant that they were broken and beaten. They were being surveyed by the state. But I actually think that because they kept their vision alive of what they were trying to do, that they were actually kind of emboldened by these experiences, especially if you look at what happened after in terms of the building of these institutions, especially the DeSalle Museum. So it's, yeah, I guess I kind of disagreed with Drake in that one moment, even though, you know, most of his scholarship is incredibly important, of course, and, you know, impacts, you know, so much else. But I thought it was just helpful as well that he made that comment about these black leftists who'd gone in for the study of black history. You know, that to me really struck me as like, well, that's kind of like a, you know, that sort of golden nugget you look for as a historian, like, okay, so that makes sense. That makes sense why all these people are not necessarily like, you know, continuing to be involved in like the civil rights movement out on the streets or in the labor movement, for example, right, where a lot of the Cold War repression was really coming down hard through that period, right, early 50s. People, you know, if they were going to advocate for civil rights, had to be also, you know, advocating for, you know, pro-Americanism, right, or something like that. So, you know, just thinking about what this group of people who were active in the 40s were doing to kind of negotiate that early Cold War period and to keep doing, you know, social activism and social justice activism.
And it's really wild to me how the surveillance state, you know, is very central to a lot of the productions of history right now, and how a lot of folks are writing about the 20th century like yourselves, and they're incorporating records from effectively the surveillance state. So I think that, like, I had that epiphany when you were speaking before, and I was just like, oh shoot, like that's kind of wild. Like, you know, she was in Mexico, and you know about the history of Lorraine Hansberry's father, who goes to Mexico as well. And so, you know, obviously Hansberry's name is very important to the city of Chicago in so many ways. So I thought that part was also something that was pretty intriguing, especially when we talk about, you know, people trying to revise history, who are a lot of times the people who are inhibiting history in the way that this surveillance state had its tentacles into so many different things.
It was really pervasive in this period, and like it affected a lot of people's lives and labors, and you know, it had this you know, this effect on you know, the shape of the civil rights movement as it was reemerging in the 1950s. You know, sort of the Cold War civil rights narrative, like scholars like Mary Dudziak have written about, and you know, Carol Anderson, I think, really well. Those are critical works. But I like to, you know, especially in my work, I've tried to incorporate the perspectives of scholars who've been trying to kind of push against that framework as well, like Mary Helen Washington. You know, I'm looking at on my bookshelf right now, The Other Blacklist, which is a great book that kind of really speaks to exactly, you know, what you're just talking about with the effect of the security state on you know, black left cultural workers going through that early Cold War period, and what they were doing to kind of, you know, continue to engage in cultural struggles and political struggles. There's also like Bill Mullen's work and James Smethurst, who's written a lot on like the origins of the black arts movement, I think makes a lot of these connections. And, you know, he's done some work on, you know, the effect of the security state on a lot of these movements. But he's one of these scholars as well that is trying to make and look at these connections between this earlier period of the 30s and the 40s with the, you know, 50s and the 60s, that sort of long civil rights narrative that, you know, Jacqueline Dowd Hall wrote about, you know, which is well over 10 years ago now. You know, I think that scholars are continuing to kind of make those connections and kind of further try to kind of complicate the sort of received narratives of, like, you know, the traditional periodization of the civil rights movement, you know, like the 50s and the 60s, which of course is still there, and it's not to discount it. You know, you can see how things really accelerated at a certain point after Supreme Court finally revises Plessy versus Ferguson, but it took a whole lot of other people working behind the scenes for decades before that for that to get to that point, even with the, if you look at the NAACP activism that's been going on for decades prior, right? So,
mm-hmm. And for me, one of my, I would say my favorite chapter, if you, you know, make me choose, you know, I would choose your third chapter. And if you don't mind, I've actually never done this for a program, but I want to do something different on this one. On page 75 at the bottom portion, do you mind if I read a portion that I thought was my favorite portion? Very good. And so, and I quote, "Indeed, the stated purpose of organizations such as the Afro-American Heritage Association and much of their educational efforts was to promote accessible Black history in the community that clearly stated how U.S. history to that point largely elided Black American contributions to the nation. Moreover, by advancing a radical revisionist analysis of U.S. history, one that indicated the role white supremacy and racial ideologies played in the promotion of such faulty views of the past, the AAHA and its allies hoped they could encourage the development of a radical political consciousness among the city's African American working class." That right there blew me away. I was like, that is exactly, in my eyes, the point of things like public history, and not only, you know, public history, or Black history, but also activism as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's what those figures like Christine Johnson and Ishmael Flory were trying to do in that time, right? Like Christine Johnson she was the principal of the Nation of Islam for a period of time, the Nation of Islam University in Chicago. And, you know, before that, she'd had, you know, connections to the Black Popular Front. So she wasn't someone that was fully in the mold of like the cultural nationalism of, you know, the leaders of the Nation of Islam. And there's lots of figures. I think there's lots of new studies now on the Nation of Islam that have, you know, complicated that organization's history. So beyond just this kind of conservative cultural nationalism that often gets, you know, reproduced in, you know, most conventional histories, right? But, you know, figures like Christine Johnson, who are working locally on the ground, were advancing these kind of really innovative visions of the role of public history and education at the grassroots level that was outside of the arm of the state, outside of, you know, surveillance, and that was trying to also revise American history from the bottom up, right? Like, you know, fully cognizant of some of the most innovative scholarship that was existing in that time, like Du Bois and others who were had done so much to revise like the you know, the plantation models of you know, like the history of slavery and stuff like that, you know, and they were putting this at the public school grade level, right, to, you know, have for kids to learn about. And I think that, you know, from the 21st century, we can look at some of the modules and think, well, that's pretty, you know, it's just sort of creating sort of heroes and it's too simplistic. But in fact, in that moment, you know, if you looked at the average American history textbook in a public school, there wasn't anything like that in that curriculum. So the fact that these people were doing these kinds of educational efforts in that moment is, I argue, was pretty groundbreaking. And, you know, they didn't have a lot of support for it at that time, as was evidenced by, you know, how small the Afro-American Heritage Association was and the kind of surveillance that it underwent. But at the same time, you know, it was doing something incredibly important and, you know, was really kind of a repertoire of the overall picture of civil rights struggles in that period.
And also in that particular chapter and in later chapters, you talk about the importance of Chicago's Black arts movement and also the importance of really in your cultural fronts and public history activism portion. You talk about arts and politics as well. And, you know, you got you the 1940s, late 1940s and 1950s, going in the 60s, there's so much going on, you know, Robeson, Belafonte, Pottier, you know, Hansberry. There's so much happening as far as arts and politics that it just, you know, you cannot you know, you can't really even speak about it enough, about the importance of, you know, figures like that in trying to raise the consciousness of Black community members. Would you be able to speak upon that as well, and how it intersected as well with the Disabled Museum?
Sure. Like, are we talking about sort of like people who were like cultural icons through that period who were kind of making an impact at the community level?
Right. I was just giving them as like the more more commonly associated, but also about how just in general the Chicago Black Arts Movement and also the individuals on the ground and how they worked with the Disabled Museum and other in other areas of Black heritage and such like that as well, and in production.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think, I mean, a lot of, you know, the work that went into building the Disabled Museum, you know, came out of, you know, the prior efforts of figures like Margaret Burroughs and, you know, her, a lot of her close friends and associates, Fern Gayden, a number of others, were all sort of, you know, they were all active in the Black, what's called the Black Chicago Renaissance in the 30s and the 40s and right through parts of the 50s. And they helped build organizations like the Southside Community Arts Center, which had been established during the New Deal period. And you know, it was a vibrant literary and cultural scene that rivaled, you know, the Harlem Renaissance in New York in terms of scope and size. But it's sort of not as well known. And I think that it had a big impact as well on the sort of ability of a lot of the people who'd been involved in that movement of that Renaissance. Anne Mace Neufer has written a lot about this, as well as Darlene Clark Hine. You know, a lot of these, the people who'd been involved in that that cultural Renaissance, many of them were women, you know, continued to work on cultural activism right through this period. And I think that's that kind of milieu is what Lorraine Hansberry is kind of also coming out of, because she, you know, having grown up in Chicago, she would have been very cognizant of that cultural milieu, right? You know, very kind of aware of it. I mean, always I think about her iconic play Raisin in the Sun, and how it's sort of, you know, I've listened to this old interview that she did right around the time that it was first staged on Broadway, and she's reflecting about how it was a product specifically of like a Southside Chicago family's experience, right? You know, partly autobiographical and all that, as you know. And you know, I think that her sensibilities also connected in making such an iconic play was also connected to you know, the marvelous growth of these cultural institutions that had maintained themselves in Black Chicago through that period. And like that's gets back to what we were talking about earlier with the sort of significance of, you know, the Black metropolis in Chicago and the sort of cultural and well, the institutional presence of organizations, of businesses, you know, churches, of, you know, like a bricks and mortar presence that had been in the city for such a long time. And I think that that has an imprint on why these cultural labels were possible through this period, right? So, you know, even on people who were on the radical left could still maintain themselves because there was such an institutional presence. Like thinking of Jeff Helgeson's work here too, on sort of community formation through this period, and sort of the connections between civil rights activism and like you know, building Black businesses, you know, through the growth of Black Chicago, right? Or Christopher Reed's work. You know, there's you know, this connects to like obviously a huge body of scholarship just on Chicago. You know, I think that these educational efforts would not have been possible had there not been that sort of longstanding institutional presence of you know, independent organizations and businesses and spaces that were that enabled these kinds of things to take place in the context of like, you know, an otherwise fairly repressive Cold War, you know, Jim Crow America.
Yeah, and so can you also speak a bit about how you had in the later portion of the Civil Rights Movement in the late 60s, and how the DuSable Museum was kind of like a bridge between the old guard Civil Rights Movement folks and also like the younger generational folks that would have gone into the Black Panther Party and folks like Henry Hampton and not Henry Hampton, that's for something else, but for Fred Hampton rather. Could you speak about kind of like how the museum helped to bridge those divides as well and to show even more why it's an important institution?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like, it's not like the museum was like hosting Black Panther meetings or anything like that, but I think that they were making connections to like younger generations who were involved in the kind of Black Power activism that we see coming out of the mid to late 60s. So, you know, figures like Haki Madhubuti, who founds Third World Press, that ultimately, you know, like a figure of the Black Arts Movement in Chicago. He's mentored very closely by Margaret and Charles Burroughs. In fact, he's written a lot recently and talked a lot recently about those connections. Figure like Sterling Stuckey, who is also, you know, not really necessarily part of that Black Power generation, but, younger in the early 1960s, is very influenced by Margaret and Charles Burroughs and goes on to be, you know, one of the, you know, key figures in the founding of African American studies through, you know, the late 60s, 70s, and onwards. You can find lots of connections like this back to the museum and the cohort of people that kind of built it through the early 60s. And, you know, I think they're also, it's also connected to the kind of programs that they devise for young people, right? There's efforts to kind of get a lot of school kids to come and visit the museum. There's like prisoner outreach programs in the late 60s, which are really fascinating, that I think connect really well with, you know, people who are becoming active in like, you know, combating police violence making connections with people who are criminalized in the criminal justice system and like enabling their education, of course. And like, that's the kind of thing that, you know, is still totally relevant today. And like they were doing it in like the 60s. Right. And there's a lot of connections to the sort of younger generations that we see in that, especially in that like fourth chapter, especially Black Arts Movement figures, people who were involved in kind of production of murals in the South Side of Chicago, which are obviously very important for form of like artistic production in the Black Power era. You think of the Wall of Respect, which is a really iconic mural that was removed by the Daley administration in the early 70s. There were connections with some of the artists who were involved in, organizations like AfriCobra, and Black Arts Movement organizations in Chicago that again had connections to, that kind of older guard leftists, like Margaret Burroughs and others who were, part of, continuing to do and support that kind of work, you know, right through the 60s. And, you know, the whole sort of growth of the museum through that period, I think, is connected to those intergenerational collaborations. The book tries to tell that part of that story.
And also with the last couple minutes that we do have you, would you be able to talk to us a bit about kind of like the museum is still around and the story is still being told. But as someone who's written this particular story, what is, in your mind, one of the important legacies of this particular period? About the civil rights activism from World War II into the Cold War, as this story is being told through the Black public history activist group that we spoke about throughout our interview. What do you think their legacy should be to folks?
I think it's probably just like the importance of like maintaining independent cultural and political organizations during periods of like repression and austerity. Like, we're in a period now where public education is under attack everywhere, and like public schools are getting closed, as well as like ongoing incidences of basically like the criminalization of Black and brown life, across North America, anti-immigrant xenophobia and racism. And so having sort of independent cultural institutions that are not going to be sort of beholden to like a large power body, whether it's like the federal government, especially under the Trump administration, a large university or corporation. Like, I mean, lots of good can happen within universities, but just having kind of grassroots independent organizations that are built from the ground up that can continue to do these kind of labors, I think, is the lesson for the current moment, and kind of maintaining them. And I think the Dusable Museum has faced challenges on that front, you know, especially through the late 20th century. And I myself and other scholars have written about that, and maintaining kind of institutional solvency. And but I think it'll continue to survive, and as other institutions that are independent will continue to survive. But people need to support them, and I think that's one of the lessons of the current moment, is that energy needs to be put into the local and the sort of grassroots to keep these kinds of things going, because of what's happening, the austerity that's happening around us in the world.
Most definitely. And and also, can you tell us with this amazing, amazing book, we get a little greedy on the New Books in African American Studies channel, where we have such phenomenal authors and historians on the program. We want to know when to expect them back, and maybe a little bit of a look into what the next project might be for you. So with that being said, would you mind telling us, now that this project is over, what can we look forward to in the future for you, Ian?
Well, I don't know if I could be included among the pantheon of amazing authors that you've had and books, but I'm just glad to be part of the conversation and appreciative to have my book talked about in this great podcast series you have. I learned a lot, from listening to your podcasts, and then, going back through the catalog. It'll be really, really helpful for those of us who are continuing to try and work on projects. And if I'm able to get to a next project outside of my teaching schedules, I'm working on a new project that relates to racial inequality in Chicago and other American cities, connected to what I view as kind of like a Catholic anti-racism. There's a lot of Catholic communities, and especially in the urban north, that were very violently racist, especially to Southern migrants, Southern Black migrants, as they were moving up during the Great Migration. And so I'm trying to look at my new study is going to look at people who were trying to kind of resist that racism from within the Catholic community. So I'm interested in connections between religious identity and anti-racism, and then also, Catholic forms of racism, which existed in the urban north that were different than in the south. So it's kind of a different project than what I was doing before, but I think it connects to, people who were interested in social change and during the same period in American history.
Very well then. And so with that project, we're definitely looking forward to once it materializes and gets published, we'll definitely have you on for a return visit to the New Books Network's African American Studies channel. And so thank you again for being on the program today. And we definitely look forward to having you on once your teaching schedule gets taken care of, as we all know how that goes. And so we totally understand. We definitely appreciate you for your time, and we definitely want to have you on again when the time is conducive.
For sure. Thanks so much, Adam. I really appreciate the time you took.
Most definitely. And so once again, New Books in African American Studies listeners, we have had on the podcast today Dr. Ian Roxborough Smith, who teaches North American and global history at the University of the Fraser Valley and Douglas College in British Columbia. And so once again, we had him on because of his phenomenal book published this year through our friends at the University of Illinois Press, entitled Black Public History in Chicago, Civil Rights Activism from World War II into the Cold War. Until next time, New Books and African American Studies listeners, I am your host, Adam McNeil. Over and out.